Support for State Week comes from the following sponsors: Visit Springfield, PIORG, and the Illinois Education Association.
From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We're about a week away from the scheduled adjournment of the spring legislative session. It's a busy time at the State House as bills that have been talked about for months, and some that have not, are starting to move. We'll get an update here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie has also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Mike Miletich. He's a reporter with WAND-TV in Decatur. He covers the State House for them. And Mike, thanks for being with us again.
Always happy to be back on, Sean. Thank you.
So, Mike, several parts moving in these final days in the spring session. Let's jump to some legislation that has advanced. And the first one I thought we could talk about, one that got a lot of attention, has to do with many call junk fees. So, first of all, fill us in on what these are and what would the legislation do?
Sure. Well, junk fees are any of the hidden prices and fees that are included once you already purchased an item and you think, hey, I've paid the full price, but you see that there's a lot more nickel and dimes that are added on to your fee. And this plan would create transparency for consumers for the whole entire price. It makes it unlawful for any business to advertise, display, or offer a price for products that does not include all mandatory fees or surcharges before the taxes come into play. And this could be critical because sponsors and the governor's office say that these fees cost an average family of four $3,200 each year. That's massive.
So these are those types of things, like let's say a concert ticket, a lot of people do those, and they wind up, you look at it and you say, oh, the seats are $85, and that's pretty good for a concert these days. And you see all these other fees when you finally get the bill. Is that what we're talking about, these sort of add-ons that are there?
That's right. You know, many of the things we're talking about, booking a hotel room, purchasing tickets online, food delivery, very popular. Or even if you go to a general store to get a new shirt, you know, that things are being added on left and right. And this says that you need to be able to see every single fee included on your purchase before you're able to buy it.
And Charlie, that to me sounds like pretty good consumer-focused legislation.
Yeah, it is. And I think the bottom line is that the governor is in favor of this, and he said he's going to sign it. As a matter of fact, his quote was, Illinois consumers have been nickeled and dimed out of thousands of dollars per year by unnecessary and deceptive junk fees. I am proud that the Illinois General Assembly has passed the Junk Fee Ban Act to put money back in the pockets of families and establish fair, honest pricing from concert tickets to online shopping. And it passed with good bipartisan support. It passed this week 46 to 12 in the Senate, and earlier last month it passed the House 77 to 18. So there's some retail and business groups that are opposed to it because they don't like having to put all this stuff up front, but they're going to be subject to it because, as I say, the governor has indicated he's going to sign it, and the bill is on its way to his desk.
And Mike, let me ask on this, is this include things like taxes? Because there's a lot of different taxes that show up in people's on people's bills once they, again, buy a concert ticket, hotel room, whatever. They may not see those before they get to the final, you know, or see their final bill. Would that include everything?
So it's interesting you bring that up, and it is important to note that these are all the extra fees before taxes. So surcharges, yes, those need to be included. Other fees have to be included, but the taxes are separate.
It looks like that will become law. Like I said, a lot of legislation moving. Another one has to do with electric rates. And people saw that last year, saw their power bills go up. There is a lot of discussion about trying to do something to rein that in. one of the things could be to, especially people who are at the lower end of the economic scale, allowing those people a little bit more of a break. There is a program already called LIHEAP. And Mike, what's some legislation that's moving right now? What does that do to help those folks?
So this plan could increase the income eligibility threshold for the low-income home energy assistance program. And sponsors say that this small change could help more households qualify for the help that they need. So basically, we're looking at an area where people could have the opportunity, let's say if they're just above the threshold for the low income program, maybe they're just below the middle class. This is going to help those people get the benefits of the LIHEAP program. But there are Republicans who are opposed to this idea. They say this is going to be another rate increase on the rest of the state, middle income and all the people that are in the upper class across the state. They said that if we're talking about affordability, the state cannot afford to do this. Now, Democrats say the bill will actually save residential, commercial, and industrial ratepayers money by using federal funding first. That's a big thing when you're talking about LIHEAP. Federal funding is a major portion of that. And this plan passed out 42-17 in the Senate and 74-37 in the House. So clearly, the Republican opposition there was shown.
Now, Charlie, Republicans, do they have a point with this? And I say this in the sense that LIHEAP's been around a long time, as we know, but expanding it at a time we're seeing such growth in the power bills that people are paying, could it have some unintended consequences here?
Yeah, I would argue that whatever consequences this would have, it would be pretty much negligible in terms of what is coming down the line with all these data centers. And all the AI installations, that's where your power bills are really going to go through the ceiling.
So at the same time, LIHEAP's been a pretty successful program, Charlie. It's like been around for, I don't know how many decades now.
Yeah, I don't know when it started, but it has been around for a very long time, and it has been very successful.
So we'll watch for that as well. Mike, where does that stand? Is that on its way to the governor's desk?
It is hanging to the governor's desk.
Okay. So we'll watch for that, see what the governor decides to do. Some other legislation, controversial legislation, almost everything is these days. One that would allow for birth control for minors without parental consent. This has always been a hot topic as far as, you know, both sides are concerned, because there are people who say, hey, parents need to know what their kids are up to. At the same time, there's others who say, some children do not have a good home situation and not always able to go to their parents to talk about this. And of course, there's also issues of sexual abuse that take place. So, Mike, this bill looks like it is, I believe it's going to the House now, you told me. It's already passed the Senate. Is this likely to get through?
I think that it will. You know, we've seen many different ways the state has expanded access to birth control over recent years, as well as other reproductive health care. And as you noted, this truly addresses people that are in some of the worst positions. Maybe their family isn't as supportive. Maybe it's a situation where someone has been trafficked and they're a victim of sexual violence. The state is trying to ensure that these people receive the access that they deserve. And, you know, there is strong opposition to it from Republicans who are opposed to most birth control measures. But, you know, the debate in the Senate got interesting because you have the Republicans that are always standing in opposition to these plans that basically argued, you know, hey, we need to do whatever we can to support these individuals, have the parental figures that they need. But sponsors, Democrats say, this is a situation where someone who is a victim or a survivor needs to receive this help, and we're going to step up where others have not. It passed out on a partisan vote earlier this week in the Senate, goes back to the House, and this is the type of bill that I think will pass partisan out of the House, and the governor would likely sign that into law.
Charlie, this strikes me again as one of those where there are two sides to every bill, and you can understand where both sides are coming from. but it almost seems like it's a little more of an issue of fairness here, because not everybody comes from a great background. Not everybody has that parental structure that allows them to, you know, have the access to what they need, especially in reproductive health care. So it's been out there. This idea has been out there before. I believe I read where about half the states have a similar law already, so it's not unprecedented. But to get your thoughts on this bill, what do you think? You think the time is right for this to happen?
Yeah, I think it is. And as a matter of fact, there are 24 states plus the District of Columbia that allow minors to consent to receiving contraceptives on their own. And the difference is, as was pointed out, there's the kind of the ideal family situation where the parents and the kids are in good touch with each other. And then there are others that are really dysfunctional. And the Republicans, Senator Jill Tracy from Quincy, said in comments on the floor, it's just disheartening that we continually think that government knows better than a parent knows about their children. I recognize not all children have ideal home situations, but that's not to say that most do. And so this bill addresses those that don't, but it also affects those that do. And so I think her concern is misguided in the sense that we're talking about the kids who don't have that kind of home relationship and for whom the availability of these contraceptives is a backstop.
Mike, you mentioned earlier Republicans stand in opposition to this. That has not always been the case. You've always had, you know, pro-abortion or anti-abortion people in both parties through the years, but we're not seeing that as much these days. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think since the time that I've been covering the state legislature full time over the past 6 years, the national discussion on this has really gone to a heated area. You know, it started with the rise of President Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. I think, honestly, you don't see a more moderate stance on this anymore within the Republican Party, because if people did, they would not survive elections in the Republican Party. And that's why we see more people speaking out in a more conservative approach to this.
Yeah, Charlie, you'd agree with that. I mean, the parties have, this has been a dividing line for the two parties, right?
Yeah, and more so currently. And it's like we've talked about on the show in the past many times, a guy like a Jim Edgar or a guy like a Jim Thompson could not get elected as a Republican, or Dick Ogilvie, despite the fact that those three are among the best governors the state ever had. But they could not get elected in the current climate, if you will, of the fact that the Republican Party, the rank and file, is pretty much solidly behind whatever the president wants. And so they're going to follow him off a cliff. And if you don't agree with them, they'll work against you and try and defeat you in the elections. And so for me, it's really a strange, what would you say, environment, because for most of the years that I was covering this kind of stuff, yeah, there were people who were, what would you say, pro-feminism and pro-birth control, acceptive of abortion on the Republican side, and there were people who were against it on the Democrat side. And now the right to lifers on the Democratic side are not as numerous as they were in the past, whereas the people who want to control everyone else's sexuality on the Republican side are pretty much the dominating factor.
You're listening to State Week.
Support for State Week comes from Visit Springfield, featuring dozens of attractions and overnights on Route 66 in the capital city. Springfield is home to numerous Lincoln sites, Frank Lloyd Wright's Dana Thomas House, the Illinois State Capitol, and more. The Visit Springfield team can help organizers plan their event in the capital city. Attractions and tourism information at visitspringfieldillinois.com.
We're back on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler and Mike Miletich of WAND-TV. Mike, I'll go back to you. Another bill that you'd reported on has to do for schools with homeless students. And this has become a really big issue for a lot of schools trying to deal with students who don't have a place to stay or a stable home. And at times are having to drop in and out of school because of this. Now there's some legislation. Let me start that. This legislation, what would it do to help that situation?
This plan would allow the school districts to provide an extended motel stay for students and their parents, guardians, or the person who enrolled them in school. And sponsors say that this addition is critical because students struggle to get to school when they don't know where they will sleep. And schools currently have the opportunity to help people with rent payments, mortgage payments, you know, for those that are on the verge of losing their homes. But this, like you said, is a perfect opportunity for people who may have just lost their home and they don't know what's going to happen. The sponsor, Senator Karina Villa, said that when she was working in school, she actually had a family who ended up losing their van. They were living in their van for a short period, and they lost that van, and the van had the school backpacks with the school homework in there, and the students didn't know what they would do. And this is the type of situation that this bill could address.
I guess one problem with it, people might say, is where does the money come from? So let me ask you that.
The money does come from the school districts. They have the mandated funding that's within their state budget funding that they get each year with the evidence-based funding model. The mandated categoricals that go to them, this funding is available. It's the same as the funding available for the buses, special transportation that bring kids to school. It's that same area of school funding.
And Charlie, this gets back to that whole idea that kids that, you know, drop out of school, aren't doing well in school, it's setting them up to fail in life quite often. I'm not saying that they can't overcome it. Some have done that, but it makes it so much harder.
Anything that would help a student have a settled situation will help them in their studies, because if they have uncertainty at home, they don't know where they're going to sleep tonight, they don't know where they're going to do their homework, that affects their mental condition as they're there in school. They shouldn't have to be worrying about that kind of stuff when they're trying to study. So I think this is a good idea. And I'm thinking that it's something that the governor will probably sign when it reaches his desk, and that it will be pretty well received in school districts across the state, particularly as the number of homeless people increases.
Mike, just one question on this too. And I have not looked this part up, but is there a limit on how much can be spent on a particular student or family? Is there, or could this go on, say, for the entire school year?
There is not a limit within the bill language, but the intent of it, which is something important that's always brought up in floor debate, the intent is that this would likely be for people to have a temporary situation. This is people that may have lost housing for a short period, or people that are trying to go in between a shelter to a new home, that type of situation.
Okay, you're listening to State Week.
Support for State Week comes from the members of the Illinois Education Association, serving 135,000 members of educators and support professionals around Illinois. IEA's mission is to promote excellence and equity in public education. When schools and communities unite, we all win. Resources and membership information at ieanea.org.
So we're back on State Week, and Mike Miletich with us, our guest this week. Mike, another piece of legislation I wanted to mention, also another one getting some attention, is one that would require certain businesses, these are a little bit larger businesses, to pay employees during jury duty. That has now gone to the governor's desk, apparently. So fill us in on what this would do.
Yes, this bill would make a vast change for folks that go to jury duty that know they're only going to get paid a small amount, you know, a few dollars per day, if they go in to a county court. If they go to federal court, they're making $50 a day, and that is a pretty good wage for serving the civic duty. This would ensure that your employer would be the one that's paying you for any time that you're away for jury duty. And it does have a lot of pushback from the business community, specifically small businesses, because they say this should be the government's responsibility, not upon them. Now, each workplace may have their own way of going about this. You know, some say we will pay you, or you need to take a vacation day, whatever the situation is, if you're getting paid more by the court. I think that it will be a case-by-case basis depending on what their business already does. But people didn't want a one-size-fits-all approach for this. And I do feel that this one will pass out and gain the support enough that it'll head to the governor's desk.
Charlie, this is the type of, I believe it's 20 over 25 employees. It would impact those businesses. But that still could be a problem for some of these businesses, especially if you're on one of those trials that lasts like a month or two. You'd be without an employee, plus you're having to pay for that employee. So, you know, if we're talking a day or two, it's probably not as big of a deal, but certainly it could really, I would think, hamstring some of these businesses. Any thoughts on this piece of legislation?
Well, I think the difficulty is going to be with the smaller operations. So not only would you be paying the salary of Wheeler, who's sitting there in the courtroom and not doing his work for the business, you'd also have to hire somebody else to do the work that Wheeler should be doing. So I think that could be a real downside. On the other hand, my guess is that judges would be very sympathetic to me if I come in and say, I really can't do this because my job just requires me to be there, and it would be a real burden for my employer to have to find somebody else to do it. So I think there'll be wiggle room in terms of how the courts will look at this.
Mike, there is a limit there on the types of businesses it would impact.
And actually, this is for any business with 25 employees or more. It is important to note what Charlie mentioned, that there are people who say, I don't know if there will be enough people to replace me for that day. Let's say it's someone who's in a rural community that's working out on a farm, or someone that works in a manufacturing site. But sponsors say that this bill could address these issues because so many people in the past have gone to the courthouse and said, I just can't do this. I'm going to find any way I can to not be part of jury duty. And the trial lawyers were the ones behind this plan, saying, we want you to be able to participate in this process.
Okay, we'll watch for that as well. As we near the end of the show here, Mike, there are still several big issues that are on the table, of course, still trying to put a budget through at the very end. But also we're watching the issue with data centers, what's known as the Power Act, that would put some guardrails on data centers. Does it look like this is going to make it through?
Anything can happen in the final week of session. I do think it's important for listeners to know that that plan has only received a subject matter hearing and press conferences throughout the year. We really have not seen much movement at all on that plan. At the same time, so many of the communities in my viewing area have had votes on whether or not their city, town, municipality wants to have data centers there. And many of those communities have voted for a moratorium.
Right. And many times waiting to see if the state's going to do something. The other big issue is the Chicago Bears. We are waiting to find out if a new stadium package of some sort is going to be approved, allowing them to stay in the state of Illinois. Of course, they have a site picked out in Arlington Heights. Indiana's already taken action to try to lure the Bears to a new site in Hammond, Indiana. And now there seems to be some discussion of whether or not the Bears could stay in Chicago. So where does this all stand?
The Bears themselves kind of put a kibosh on this notion. Mayor Johnson has been promoting that, the Bears can stay here in Soldier Field and we can upgrade Soldier Field, that he's been pushing for the last, gosh, I don't know how long. But yesterday, Thursday afternoon, the Bears released a statement saying, the Chicago Bears have exhausted every opportunity to stay in Chicago, which was our initial goal. There is not a viable site in the city. As a result, the only sites under consideration are in Arlington Heights and Hammond. So I think that pretty well would rule out Mayor Johnson's hope of keeping the Bears in Chicago.
It's time now for our notes from the field, so we'll start with Mike this week.
I followed a bill that was in the Illinois Senate on Thursday that could reduce barriers to menopause care. Current state law requires insurance coverage for FDA-approved menopause treatment, but this bill broadens the coverage requirements, stating that private health insurance needs to cover medically necessary evaluation and treatment of perimenopause and menopause conditions, including hormone conditions and medications. That plan passed out on a 54-4 vote and now heads to the House.
All right. And Charlie?
Well, there was what I would consider a very monumental decision that came out of the federal court in Chicago this week, and it's the final twist to the highest profile criminal case resulting from Operation Midway Blitz, which was the Department of Justice's attempt to round up and deport anyone who is not a U.S. citizen. So what happened on Thursday, the Department of Justice dropped all charges against the remaining Broadview 6 protesters, there are four remaining, citing apparent prosecutorial misconduct in the grand jury proceedings that led to their indictment. U.S. District Judge April Perry told the U.S. attorneys on the case that she was, quote, incredibly shocked by the redactions in an earlier version of the grand jury transcript compared with a full unredacted version. And so apparently the prosecutors did stuff that's really beyond the pale in terms of trying to prejudice the grand jury against the defendants. And the bottom line is, as I say, the charges were all dropped. Now there would be sort of the irony. Donald Trump has this slush fund going that anybody who thinks that they were harmed by, what would you say, judicial activities because they were a Trump supporter, they can come and get money from him. And so it occurs to me, I wonder if these defendants and some of the other people who were arrested and charged with this Operation Midway Blitz, if they are going to be able to apply and get some of this slush fund money from Trump. If I'm not mistaken, the tally, I don't think anybody who has really been convicted of charges yet, with Thursday's dismissals, 24 of 33 people charged with federal non-immigration crimes tied to this campaign have been cleared. Four others struck deals to have their cases eventually dismissed. Two people only have pleaded guilty. So it's a pretty, what would you say, sorry record for a U.S. attorney's office that before this had a pretty darn good record of rarely losing.
We're out of time for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and WAND-TV's Mike Miletich. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
Support for State Week comes from PiOrg, a nonprofit consulting firm providing resources for strategic planning, best practice implementation, and outcomes-focused program evaluation across the country, helping organizations make data understandable and actionable, enabling changemakers to strengthen critical skills and serve others more effectively. Pi. Plan, implement, evaluate. Services and information at piorg.org.